Hey man, how you doing?
Very good. Very good.
Happy birthday,
thank
brother.
Thank you. Thank you. It is my birthday.
I'm awesome.
40 years old.
Amazing. 40. Amazing. 40. I don't see any gray hair, so I don't know about that. You sure?
Yeah, no. 40? I'm sure.
Nice, man. That's a great number.
It is. It is great. I like it.
You know, now, it just so happens that today is also Channel 9's birthday.
Yes.
We turn 9.
9. Lots of videos.
So rock and roll to all the Niners out there and everybody that produces content, everybody that's been on camera, you know who you are.
Yeah.
Amazing stuff.
It
we love
great.
You.
It was great. Yeah.
And Goldenus made a wonderful video people should watch. 9 minutes of 9. Beautiful stuff. Takes you through the history.
Beautiful.
So and I want to ask a question because 49 and 20, the smart people out there should figure out what's the pattern.
Okay.
Right? Come back to us with information about what the pattern is.
Okay.
But in terms of visual C++, why did you call it visual C++?
It's Visual C++ 20th birthday.
Yes.
And we call it Visual C++ because, you know, I asked the people that were there for Visual C++ 1.0,
mm-hmm.
and there was Visual Basic, and they wanted to brand this new C++ in a certain way, and mm-hmm. basically they added Visual, and they kind of created a Visual Studio brand with that. That was just a pretty cool story, right?
So Visual C++ also is sort of like the beginning of Visual Studio.
Yeah, and then we moved to Visual Studio overall mm-hmm. after Visual C++ 6. And
excellent.
A lot of story behind that. I met a lot of people
cool.
when we got together for this birthday for Visual C++.
Right on. Well, happy birthday to everybody out there involved with Visual C++.
Yes,
and for
true.
C++ programmers,
yeah.
regardless of whether or not you use Visual C++, rock and roll to you. Huge kudos to you guys. You make a wonderful product.
Thanks.
Now, I caught up with Jan Gray
and
Rico Mariani.
Rico Mariani, yes.
Those guys were sort of on the original team.
They were there
you know,
to do the first one.
Totally.
The first Visual C++.
And they tell us about some of the big problems they had, you know, implementing Visual C++ 1.0. And you know what? I think folks are going to learn stuff they've never heard before.
Maybe, yeah. It's,
let's see if it's
cool
true.
Stuff.
Yeah. All right, man. All right, so we are here, this 20th anniversary of Visual C++. We're with at least one familiar face, Rico Mariani.
Hi.
Nice to see you again, man.
Nice to see you.
I didn't even know you were on the C++ team back then.
Yeah, I had two stints in DevDiv. I was in DevDiv for, before it was called DevDiv, for 7 years.
Okay.
And then I worked in MSN for about 7 years, and then I came back and worked again in DevDiv for about 7 years. I do everything in multiples of seven. So as soon as the number of years I've been here is congruent to zero mod seven, then I have to change divisions.
Excellent. And we're here with Jan Gray as well.
Hi.
And you organize this event, right? I mean, this is an event. Yeah. Tell us about it. What's going on?
Okay, so I guess 21 years ago we shipped C7, and for the going native thing last year,
I know that
we,
well.
We said, you know, we should do something to recognize C7 because that was the first C++ product from Microsoft.
From Microsoft, yeah.
And then I was thinking we should have a reunion because we had a fantastic team and people were great and it was a wonderful experience and one of the highlights in my
career. The current people are great too, let's be clear.
Oh, sure. I just don't know that.
No, that's right. Yeah.
And,
no, the current team, they're a bunch of losers.
But in thinking, you know, should we celebrate C7 as the focus of the reunion or BC++ 1.0? It was clear the Visual C++ 1.0 was the turning point, you know. So we've been looking back at you know, the product reviews and the ads and so forth around 92, 93. And if you think about it, just before C7 shipped, Borland had already shipped three versions of C++.
Yeah.
There were many other excellent rival C++ products.
Yep.
And we were still trying to get C7 out.
Yep.
And so you've been lapped twice.
Yep.
And,
yeah, that's what it felt like.
Right. I mean, C7 had some unique strengths. It had a better optimized compiler and various other things, and a hell of a lot of documentation, excellent documentation. But it didn't take the world by storm. Borland had the momentum, I think it's fair to say.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We definitely felt like, well, at least we're on the field now.
But yeah.
Really, that's how we felt. Like, okay, we're in the game, and now we get to play. And that's,
But then between what was really a long slog to get C7 done, and it shipped in April of 92, right?
That sounds right.
And then by February of 93, we had done this Visual C++ 1.0 product.
Yep.
And it was a turning point. You know, it might be that we'd be at the Borland Development Tools Company or whatever if that hadn't gone so well.
Yep.
And
we thought it was make or break for lenders. Yeah. At the time.
I remember the morale was kind of like, you know, we're behind, we're really behind.
It was much worse than that.
Yeah, sure, I know.
It was like, we're screwed. Now we're doomed.
Yeah. So one question I have for you, since you were here, you know, C++ is a tool that we use. Who at Microsoft was really excited about C++ back then? Wasn't everyone writing in C?
There were some holdouts. Kernel guys were saying, you know, we can't afford the abstraction. We can't afford the overhead of all this virtual function pointers.
But that's what they said when they switched from MASM 3 years before, right? Yeah. Microsoft has gone through these kind of renaissances more than once, right?
Sure.
You know, like everything was written in assembly, and we're like, oh, we can't afford this C compiler thing.
Yeah, look at the cause convention. Like, well, the custom
we can't afford to not, you know, pushing all those registers on the option. And that was the mentality. But then, you know, we made it through that, and we figured out how to use those tools. And then people started adopting C++, and it was a disaster. And because they didn't know what to do, they were using all these expensive
things. That's the
interesting
ASX story, right?
Yeah.
So, but I would say amongst the applications people, there was more interest in going up and having higher abstraction levels.
I think so too. But also, I think everyone was afraid of, can we afford it, and what's it going to look like? And you remember they had to build works to run on like 128K PC at the time.
We started,
you couldn't say, oh, we're going to add 5K to your total. But that's 5% of my budget.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, we started in Apps Tools, both of us.
Yep.
Okay.
And back then, one of Microsoft Applications Division's competitive advantages was that they had a P-code C compiler.
Yep.
So they could get a factor of 2 code compression versus people that were generating native code.
Yep.
And also portability and better tools and so on.
Yeah, they got some good perks from that compiler.
But to kind of come back to VC1, there was actually this, do you remember this kind of old time revival meeting? We went to this one all hands meeting.
Yep.
And it started with, are we going to, you know, give up the franchise here? And by the time, there was something magical about this one meeting, this one day at Microsoft.
And me and Jim really turned it around.
Denise Gilbert and Jim McCarthy.
Oh, yeah. There it is.
We did the prop.
That's the full size.
This is the...
weighs a few pounds.
This is the VC1 box, which if you remember the C7 box it was 50%
bigger at least.
Yeah.
So it was like 50 pounds or something.
Under 50.
It's ridiculous. And this was a mere 35 or something.
And
this is the last time we ever shipped full books, right?
Did VC15 go to CD?
CD? Yeah. By then? Yep, we were already on CD. There was a Tree Saver edition of this. Yeah. That's what I bought. I don't have this. I have the...
Yeah, but it looks better on your
shelf.
That's
what we called it, the Tree Saver edition. It was kind of, it does make a...
Even
a
that
nice
was an interesting story. You know, we had to help the developer community get CD-ROMs, right? So
a lot of people didn't have
one. The box is shipped with coupons.
They had a coupon, right?
You know, send this off, get a SCSI interface and a Shimon CD-ROM or something.
Mm-mm.
Yeah, great.
That was 1.5x drives. With the caddy, remember the CD caddy that you had to put them in?
But this is also the 20th anniversary of MSDN.
Yep.
Right. So there was some beta testing of that stuff, and of course there's Microsoft Systems Journal or whatever it was.
Yep. MSJ.
But it was really at that point that we started shipping. When you had the CD-ROMs, that's when it got practical to bundle all this stuff.
You could search all the reference material all at once,
right.
Just a little query. It was like using Bookshelf only for your docs. It was like crazy good.
Yes.
Crazy good. And I forget that, what was the guy's name? Forgive me, Dennis Adler?
Sounds familiar.
Maybe I'm wrong. Anyway, forgive me, I don't remember the name for sure. But we were beta testing it while this was all going on, and you know, getting drops of virtual CDs on Corpnet. And they were like ridiculously big, like 640 meg of data.
Are you bad?
We're like, 640 meg of data, what are you putting that? The whole source enlistment was, you know, way less than that. Our total server space was, you know, I don't want to hazard a guess, but it was way less than a gig.
Yeah.
You know, maybe a couple hundred meg.
But to finish the VC1 story, there's some magic that happened. And it was, I mean, there were several nice things that came together. Although we had many elegant IDE architectures over the years, we ended up going with something that we had that was actually working and shipping, which was the QuickC for Windows IDE, right?
Yep.
And then MFC was in version 2 at that point, and it was great.
Yep.
And even greater was the MFC stuff they did for Olay to support ODBC support that came out.
Came right after.
Five,
yep.
Right, whatever.
Yep. Bam, bam, right after, yep.
The compiler was more mature. We started doing lots of cool perf work to make that go faster.
Yeah, we had the performing gorillas. Do you remember the performing gorillas?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Gorillas.
They wanted to call us the performance gorillas, but we didn't like that because it sounded too military. So we called ourselves the performing gorillas. The performance gorillas. Yes. And we had an alias. Our email alias was gorillas like the, you know, like the ape.
Yes.
Speak of male gorillas.
I forgot.
Excellent. So we did all this fun stuff. We did, like, we made a bunch of changes in the linker. We integrated CV pack.
That's
in the
a long
linker.
Story.
We did nouns of stuff we did. To get the build cycle tighter.
Yeah, between C6 and C7, you know, we had the very traditional compilation model, header files.
Yep.
You compile your source files against those headers. Every single object file contains all of your debug information.
Yep.
Your browser files contain a copy of all the cross-reference
contains all of them,
stuff,
yep.
Right? And then what? Oh, we Orland 2.0 had a kind of pre-compiled headers,
yep.
Which were fantastic.
Yep, very helpful.
Well, they were not as
ours were better.
Ours were better. And so I said, "Hey, boss, we got to do pre-compiled headers over at Dan."
Yep.
And boss said, "No, schedule risk. No pre-compiled headers.
Can't possibly
next
do this.
Release."
Yep.
And I said, "No, we must do it." So I did it in secret. Nine evenings, I snuck out.
Yep.
"Hi, we're on camera, so I have to go over there." Yeah, okay, fine.
So first,
I'm gonna let my buddy in.
Sure, do.
He does. I'll tell the story a little bit for you.
Yeah.
While he lets in, I think that's Chuck over there. So he did this experiment where the trick to precompiled headers is you want to snapshot the heap at a given point in time, right, and then be able to reload it. And to do that, you need to be able to find every pointer in the heap so that you can fix it up again when you reload it. So you can simulate the hard part of that by saying, okay, what I'll try first is while the compiler is running, I will pick up the heap and move it to over here, right? And if I can do that successfully, then in principle, I could have written it to disk in between and then picked it up and loaded it somewhere else and that all would have been fine.
Mm-hmm.
So over the course of one weekend...
No, it was more like a week and a half.
I have a good memory.
You're better than mine.
Over the course of one weekend, you got the moving experiment working.
Yes.
And then you came in and said, "Look, I can do this whole move thing. Surely now you must admit that I can do
the schedule risk is mitigated."
Right, because I've done the tricky part,
but
right?
I think there was a week before that where I was finding all these data structures and because it wasn't designed to be moved, right? It was a 10-year-old code base already, and the pointers... Anyway.
So you can make metadata for it all, just like you would with a managed piece of code, where you have to know where all the pointers are.
Yeah, so that was Skunkworks, and that worked out well. I got a promotion out of that, so that was all right.
Nice job.
But then we did precompiled types.
Yeah, the amount of entropy that isn't in the world because of the, you know, the heat that hasn't been released from those the header files that haven't been compiled.
Yeah, so the really cool thing about precompiled headers was that we're going to write an object file that we knew was going to be linked in with the rest.
Yep.
So we pushed all of the debug types and all of the expensive size stuff into that file.
Yep.
I think we did the same thing with browser information.
The beauty of the way the PCH worked was you knew that the headers you were going to get were exactly the same.
Right.
Because you couldn't guarantee that. You know, the language semantics are like, people might include them
depending.
In different orders, at different lines, the pounding points could be different. But when you do this PCH trick, you're basically saying, no, for sure, pretend the headers look exactly like they did over there, and load that, and never mind if I had them only in approximately the right order, just use that snapshot. So that let you do all these cool optimizations further downstream. So it wasn't just that we boosted the front end speed,
exactly.
Right? We also boosted CVPAC, which we haven't talked about.
So so linking got faster.
Yep.
We got rid of 19 out of 20 copies of everything.
Yep.
Just it was a trivial hack.
Yep.
That was C7. EC1, I think we did keeping the types, debug types persistently in the PDB file.
In the PDBs. Yep.
So I'd worked on a number of things in the past that had a program database, and we worked on one at C#.
Yeah, C#.
That's another story. C# 88. Maybe that's good for another channel line, another day.
C# 88?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was another C# before the C# that you know of.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, the other C-sharp was this thing we built in AppsTools, which actually had a compilation model remarkably similar to the final C-sharp. It had this whole pretend everything is streamed and do multiple passes and then do the fix.
But it, did it spit out
Pcode.
Machine? Oh, so Pcode.
Pcode,
so
just like the Apps Pcode.
Yeah, we mentioned the Apps Pcode CS compiler. Yep. We had a little entrepreneurial team under Charles Simoni and Craig Wittenberg.
Yep.
Ah.
And there's some great, there's Bob Atkinson who did Calm, and Scott Randall who
Scott
did NFC.
Really,
super team. And that was an incremental C compiler that did away with header files, kept everything in a database, all symbols, types, object code.
Yep.
Had an incredibly fast browser that Rico did. Programming productivity. Product that Charles Simoni, or our internal project that Charles Simoni sponsored. We had a team of about 8 people, half were from Waterloo, as all good things come from the University of Waterloo.
Yeah.
And
not that we're biased or anything.
No, of course not.
And we built a incremental C compiler, incremental linker, completely incremental everything.
Yep.
It was, everything was stored in this great transacted, object-oriented database of all program artifacts. And you could pop around this object graph and have a very fast browsing experience, for example.
Right, you could use for source browsing or for expecting the type graph or whatever you wanted. It was all in there.
And because we had these dependence graphs, it meant that when you edited a source file, what did we do? We blocked the source file into these checksum regions so we could infer what you edited. We would skip to the place you edited. We would then have the compiler suck the types it needed out of the database, compile one declaration that changed, update the database, propagate the change dependence information, which queued other things that were transitively dependent on the change to be recompiled, which then triggered an incremental link, and your build was done.
Yep.
Everything about this was great, except the footprint, as is always the case.
Yes,
right?
That's right.
So this was 88-89, and I remember we had one project which was the source code that eventually became Microsoft Access.
That's right.
And it needed 8 megabytes of RAM.
8 megabytes, that's right.
And you could only do that with a LIM EMS card or whatever.
Right, that's right.
And telling...
It was too big, man. 8 meg?
Yeah. Telling the application.
No one will ever have that kind of memory.
Yeah, if every applications developer needed a machine with 8 megs of RAM, it was no sale.
Right.
So we shelved it.
Yep.
We had all these great ideas and we pledged that we'd recycle them, and we did. So QuickC2 used the incremental compile technology that we did in C#, and then later it came back in VC4, which maybe we'll talk about. The PDB files that we created, starting with I think VC1, were transacted, persistent archives, databases, because you could update pieces of them independently, of derived information, so you didn't have to re-derive it. And so in VC1, one of our performance challenges was CVPAC. What the hell is CVPAC?
Yes.
So when you would compile a source file, we generate debug information for the debugger to use. What are the symbols and what are their addresses and what
all
are the types of those things?
Yes.
And
it was the types that's the big problem.
And for every compilend, we would, I don't know how the sun's going, for every compilend, we would generate, say, 50 or 100K, I don't remember how much it was, of type information saying, you know, you got pointer to int and pointer to pointer to int and function of 2 ints returning a pointer to int and
all
struct x. All of Windows on H was a huge thing. It would generate this object graph, this graph of types. And every compilend.obj would have another of these graphs. Each one would have been created as a separate island of identifier numbers, of integers. And so CVPAC's job was, after linking, to collect all of this redundant type information and do graph isomorphism or graph subgraph matching to fold all the duplicate information together. And that took minutes. So the link took minutes, and then CVPAC took minutes.
Right, because it took as long. Like, we have all these duplicated types. They were all the same, right? It was like, it's Windows.h, here it is again. Oh, look, here it is again. And you have to analyze them all. Look, here is another copy. So, and then you'd spit it out, and it'd be like, I don't know, 1% the original size.
That was needed to make the debugger not suck
and,
at all.
And the, right, and of course, the debugger, if we fed all that into the debugger, it would have had a heart attack. So we would pack it first. And we had the same problem in the browsing space, but by that time, as soon as you added PCH, We could fold a lot of the browser stuff, so the browser stuff could be processed exactly once with separate stubs for each little component. So I only had to process the browsing information once to build the equivalent browser database. Yeah. But
we did some of that with the precompiled header.
With the precompiled header type as well. Yeah.
But it was still a killer. So the first thing we did with PDB files was put the type information there, and nothing was ever duplicated. So because we can load the assignment of types to integers from the previous compile, we could start from that.
Yep.
So it's called hash consing as a data structure thing. So you would say, do you have a type for pointer to int? Why, yes, that's 7. Do you have a type for pointer to 7? Why, yes, that's 13.
Sure.
And every compo end would do the same thing.
Yep.
And we would load the types in as part of compiling, add a few types, and write it back out.
Right.
And then
so we wrote less into the object.
Right.
Which tended to pay even for the cost of doing the lookups.
And the link was faster.
And then the link didn't have to deduplicate at all because there was no duplicates in the first place.
Yeah, so we killed CVPAC.
Yeah.
So that was VC1.
But we did and we didn't.
Oh, and we still had to do CVPAC because there's always all these other objects and libraries.
Multiple other objects, yeah.
Stuff like that.
Yeah. So we had this funky thing where during VC1, we still had the CVPAC stage and we had it substantially optimized, right?
Yes.
Plus the local types for each guy.
Oh, God.
But we'd write out all the local types and then the linker would split them out and then CVPAC would read them all right back in, pack them, and write them all back out.
Right.
So we did this slick trick where instead of exiting the linker and writing the packed information, we'd write the executable part.
I'd forgotten this. But
yeah, we write the executable part.
We
then
loaded CVPAC.
We hold our breath, holding on to the debug information we were going to write, load CVPAC, and then we aim CVPAC. Instead of, we changed every read file call in CVPAC, right, to call these methods that would figure out where the type information that's now in the linker's brain would have gone had it been written to the file.
I'd forgotten that.
Right? And CVPAC still thinks it's seeking, right? That's the best part. It still thinks it's seeking.
Yes.
So we're doing this in-memory file thing, and so then you compress that and write it out directly, and then you drop this on the floor, so the uncompressed types never hit the disk, and you end up with, you didn't have to compress as much because you had the PDBs to help you. You have some islands of stuff in OBJs here and there, and you could have more than one PDB because there's no law that says you only have one PDB.
And we handled that too.
Right, we handled it too. Yeah. So you consolidate just that much, and you never write it to disk, and then and that ends up being pretty good.
Well, that turned the link into a 1 minute thing from a 5 minute thing or a 10 minute thing or whatever it was.
Right, because the pack cost was cut, I don't know, we cut 95% off the off the pack cost.
Yeah.
So we were just left with linking is about linking.
Yes.
And a lot of the crapola was gone. So that made a huge difference.
And then in VC2 and VC4, we turned to more incremental compiler technologies. The idea is most of the time you've got your AFX project or MFC project, I'm sorry, and you add one field, you add one button to a dialog or something.
Yep.
Do you really have to recompile everything from zero?
Yep.
No. So in VC2, the work was on incremental linking. And the team took the linker and figured out how to persist some of the linker's data structures so that the next time you ran the linker, it could wake up having just linked. And then it looks at which objects are different from the last time.
Yep.
And it subtracts the binary contributions from those objects
yep.
that it had previously added in, and then it adds in the new version of those.
Right.
We used to say twice incremental is still
cheap
or something.
Still, yeah.
But we still had the debug problem.
Yep.
So in...
You have to patch all the line numbers in the debug structure.
Right. So we extended the PDB file.
And patch all the browser information.
So the PDB file had a section in it. Basically, a PDB is a file system in a file. So we had a little stream in the PDB for each object file, which had its symbols and stuff. So we would we'd subtract those and then add in the ones from the changed
objects.
Oh,
yeah, you're talking about the types. Yeah.
I'm talking about symbols now.
Oh, but the real killer is the line number info, right? Because you just do this wafer thin edit, add a comment, right? And you're like, oh, well, that won't change. We don't have to change it. There's no new types. There's no nothing. They got all the lines moved down one.
Jesus, yeah.
So when you try to step, right? You know, so there's this fix-up table, right?
Oh,
it says, oh, the line numbers, they're not, well, those aren't the real line numbers. What are you thinking? You have to apply the fix-up first, then you get the real line numbers. So this is Dan's baby, right? He's got the whole thing where...
Dan Spaulding.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And then we did the... And, of course, everything I just said about the debugger is also true for the source browser info. So I have the exact same trick where all the SBRs, I get a stub SBR that's got, oh, by the way, I wrote the line numbers. I've been, you know, I'm not giving you the whole file, but you have to patch these line numbers because everything just shifted. So even stuff that we skipped... So we had that. Plus, we could swap the a section of symbols, and we swap a section of types, and we could regenerate pieces of the publics, and
changes to the types were we only ever just appended.
We only
types.
Appended, right. And we just leave the old types
and
whatever they're not hurting.
That took linking down to tens of seconds or something. Yep. Mm-hmm. That was in VC2.
I think that was four.
For an incremental link.
I think that was four.
No, four is next. Four we did. Minimal rebuild and incremental recompilation.
Yeah, those things were happening at the same time, I think.
Okay.
They were both in 4.
Okay.
What you're talking about,
by VC2, we had killed CV Pack.
Yes.
And that was a good thing. Rest in peace, CV Pack.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
I must say, I could be wrong. Your memory.
I could be wrong. But
what's going
remember,
on
I, wrote, I know, I had to get this all in my head.
So
when I wrote that history blog, the big long thing.
Yes.
Yeah. So
this interview is turning into
Well, that's great. This is gold. This is beautiful Channel 9 material.
Okay. So let's talk VC4.
So
what about VC3?
Oh, there was
no VC3.
Oh, of course
not. No, we skipped 3 because
there was before, but the planet record killed it, and it's gone now. No, sorry, that was
so. What was VC? What was the vision of VC3?
No, VC. The VC you know is VC4 is 3. But we renamed it to 4 because the MFC number was off by 1.
Oh, of course.
So we wanted to line because we got sick of saying VC2 with MFC3, you know, and like having to add 1.
That worked out really well.
Because after that, we never revved the MFC number again for like 15 years. What a brilliant move that was. So for like 2 picoseconds, the numbers were aligned.
Yes.
But we skipped 3.
Best of intentions.
So yeah, so 3 is 4.
Okay, 3 is 4.
That is, 4, whatever. So that's Olympus. So we were doing minimal rebuild and incremental compilation.
Let's talk about those. So there's 2 kinds of edits you do now. If you're doing a small change to your project, you're changing a little bit of one source file.
Okay.
Maybe you're adding one event handler. Or you're changing one little bit of a header file. You're adding a button or something. Neither of those require all the files to be rebuilt. And in the case of editing one body of one function, you don't want to recompile most of the file either.
Right.
So we took the stuff we knew about in C#88 for checksumming regions of the source file.
Yep.
And we would compile the global parts, the global declarations in the source file, and then skip every unchanged function body.
Yep.
We had to teach the backend of the compiler to keep a database as well of what it had from before.
Yep.
And when that all boiled down, you could edit one body, one line of a function, and we would skip all the other bodies. We would generate just a little bit of intermediate language.
Yep.
We would code gen just one function, unless it was inlined, in which case we'd do the things around it that it inlined. And that sped up compiling by about a factor of 2. But it turns out that wasn't worthwhile doing. In the big scheme of things, that factor of 2 was noise. And as the machines got faster, compiling one file became less of an issue. The other one we did, which was a team with Rico and Dan, John Caves.
But it was all based on the same thing.
It's all based on PDBs enabling.
We couldn't have done minimal rebuild without half, like all the checksumming stuff that was done for ICC. We needed that for minimal rebuild as well.
Okay.
So like we were already standing on the shoulders of ICC.
And PDBs.
And PDBs from before that.
Yeah.
And which is, you know, it's turtles all the way down.
So can you explain the idea of min rebuild?
So min rebuild is... you make a change in a header file, a fairly modest change, like you add a new non-virtual method, which is exactly what happens if you add a new handler to, say, a button controlled in an MFC app.
Right.
Okay? So yeah, technically you just change the definition of the class, and you change the .h file, and the whole world includes that .h file, but, and so if you did a normal build, you'd say, oh, I have to recompile those guys. However, the particular change that you made, no one actually cares about. Okay, because we know no one is calling that function in any of the other files because you just added it, right? And you added the definition in the one file. There's some CPP file that you put the definition in. So clearly we have to compile that. So But that's actually all we have to compile. If we notice that no one else was using that method because it's brand new, once we compile the file that contains it, we're done. And typically the only references to it are in that very same file. So all these other guys, we can just say, never mind, you don't have to compile that guy.
That sounds really easy, Rico.
Yes,
that's
really easy. But remember everything I just told you about, you have to tweak all the line numbers and stuff? Yeah, there, that rears its ugly head again. So you added a new line to the .h file, now all the debugger stuff is perturbed. So so you have to fix all that, all the browser stuff is perturbed. So when you skip, you have to do a little bit of work. You have to like, okay, well, just let me record, like, you know, what should happen to the line numbers and whatever else. And we had this slick way of figuring out what was different. Because as you were saying, we never delete types from the type file, right?
That's correct.
So when you created the new version of the class, that created a new type, which we could compare to the old type.
Because
so
we had that information as well.
It's still there.
Someone added a field to point X.
Right, so we could look and see what did they do to the type, and we knew the debugger information was authoritative. So so we figure out then what they did to the type, and then depending on what you did, We knew which files needed to be recompiled because
this is the trick.
Yeah, this is the trick. So if you remember everything about who depends on what, it's too expensive.
Right. There's so many program databases of history had about 1,000 bytes of code for every line of source because they kept all these elaborate data structures.
Kind of like ours.
Yeah, yeah. And so the question was,
from C-Sharp 88.
How can we have an incredibly cheap way of remembering that I depend on the size of point of struct point, or I depend on the virtual function
some virtual index function.
of this thing. And what we eventually got to is saying each of those facts will just turn into an integer. And a fact derived on a fact will always make it that's a repeatable function. So we can, if I depend on the size of this thing, that generated an integer like 14. And if Rico, in another source file, compiles that, it'll still be 14.
Yep.
And so then we wanted to have a way of describing all the things I depend upon, which was just a set of bits. And we had this clever idea that we can fold the set of bits and use a probabilistic test, which says, is 14 in the set?
Yeah.
And we can either say, no, it's definitely not in the set, or maybe it's in the set by folding this large thing.
Yeah.
In doing so, we invented Bloom filters. We didn't know that they were called Bloom filters, but that's what we did. Yeah. And so building a Bloom filter for what I depend on in the header, and building another Bloom filter for what changed in the header, you can
just
do a very simple intersection, bit and, of these 2,000-bit vectors.
And you 98%
you know what?
Good.
The intersection is zero.
Yep.
I don't have to, there's no way that I depended on something that changed.
Skip this
file.
So the net is that the dependency information becomes tiny. We used 256 bits per class that's used in the comp land. There were typically 5 or 6 classes, I don't know, or 10 classes. So hurt me, there's like, 1,000 bits of dependency information total for any given comp land. And you could very quickly say, yes, yes, no, 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 and you're done. And it's possible that you would say yes to something that didn't really, because, he depended on something else that hashes to 14. Yes. I don't know what it is, but oh well,
it doesn't matter,
we're going to recompile that guy. It's a benign false positive. So it was 98% good. We had about a 2% false positive rate with the metrics we picked.
We just picked bit set sizes that were
pretty good. Yeah, not too big, good enough not to get too many false positives. So the net of it was you could use Class Wizard. You could add a new method, which typically would have made you recompile your entire world, and instead we'd recompile exactly the file that you needed to be recompiled and skip all the others. It was a thing of beauty.
And even that didn't make the product fast enough. That got the builds way down.
It did help.
But finally, there was no excuse for the traditional performance engineering stuff of working set analysis, profiling. And
oh my goodness.
I remember Rico had pages and pages and pages of...
I still have a notebook.
Were they VA dumps? Or
yeah, I still have a notebook of VA dumps, but also I have this thing where we flush the working set every second and then set bit for everything that was touched in the next second, and then I could watch the traces. It was like ticker tape.
Yeah.
What pages did we touch?
Why did that come in?
Like, what are you doing? You can't load that code. We're compiling. Don't you understand? No, because the killer was the machines didn't have that much memory. Yeah. And so you had the
IDE. How much memory did they have? 16 megs. That was like a big machine. That was like our.
16?
Our,
no, dude.
But our target. What was our target?
Than
was
that,
it four?
Yeah.
I can't remember.
Like 4 meg.
With, that's
eight.
With the IDE loaded and the compiler running.
Yeah. In our dreams, 16 meg.
Yeah, that's right. That was a big machine.
In our dreams. We were up to 4. So you can still imagine the database for C-Sharp 88. It's now 1992.
It's about 4.
1994? 94? No, it's past that.
95.
95 was Dolphin. So it's like...
This was 95.
No, I'm sorry. 95 is Olympus. 95 is Olympus.
Sorry.
So that's BC4. So you're right. It's about 1994. So... 2 meg machines are fairly common, and developers frequently have 4 meg machines. And then depending on whether you're running on NT or Chicago, you may not get all... Anyway. But the point is, the compiler wants all the memory to do its job. And it's important to get the heck out of the compiler's way, because if you're hogging up memory, then it doesn't have enough memory to do its job and to cache the PCH and whatever else. So the IDE has to squeeze itself into a tiny little thing while a compile is going, so that the compiler doesn't get hosed, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So we watched every little thing. And when we were finished tuning Olympus, it used, nobody believes this when I tell them, but I have the traces, 13 pages.
The IDE 13, got it.
The IDE, 13 pages.
Yes.
So that's 13 times 4K.
50K or something. Yeah.
Less than 64K, right? Yeah. 64K would be 60 pages.
Yeah.
13 pages, the whole thing. We even had to turn the caret off, because it's funny. I've been watching the traces, and I'm like, every second, there's this... All these DLLs get touched every... What the heck? And I'm looking at the screen and I'm like, blink, blink. And I'm like, it's the carrot. Yeah. You know, the carrot's now pulling in more than everything else put together. They're like, I'm turning that bad boy off. I don't need a flashing carrot during the build. So, but that's what you did.
The culmination of all this, though, is like, was it 10 seconds for a small edit on the 486-something machine of the day, which was huge compared to 5 minutes at the start of the...
Yeah.
Start of
We were down right around 10 seconds on a good box.
Yeah.
I remember the D-flat scenario, I think it was called.
Yeah.
Started
I remember
right
the name. I can't remember
45
what
D-flat? D-flat, yeah. Okay. That was the name of the test case. I don't even know what it did.
Yeah.
Did we even run it?
No, we would never
run it. We were just building it. I have no idea what it did. I imagine it did. Maybe something musical. I have no idea. So we just built the thing, and we'd be clocking, well, how much memory do you use, how much size, how big is that stuff, and where's the time going, and what's the spread. So, by the time we were done, the PDBs were sharing a bunch of stuff, and then they had more stuff. They had to do later because...
Editing continue, and that stuff was post us.
Post us. And also post us is making PDBs multi-threaded, poor Dan.
Yeah.
Because they wanted to be able to run multiple compiles at the same time. The problem with having a central database is that you lock the file, right, while it's being updated.
It was a two-phase commit thing, so it only wanted to have... It's like a write lock, one writer at a time. Yep. That's...
So he made a server, and he would send the types over, and so any number of compiles could be happening at the same time, and all the types would be transparently unified, and that would tank perf. And
Dan Spaulding.
Dan was substantially responsible for... I talk about minimal rebuild like I wrote all the code. It is too loud, right? Dan wrote most of what I'm talking about.
Yes.
I was doing all the line number fix-ups for our browser stuff and whatever else. And driving requirements and whatever else. Dan wrote all the compiler driver stuff that we're talking about. Dan wrote all that.
So where's Dan these days?
I know where he'll be tomorrow.
He's coming to dinner tomorrow.
He's coming to dinner
How we made the compiler faster story. Little semester. So tomorrow we're having a reunion dinner for about 80 people.
Cool.
And actually, Facebook is a good way to find friends of friends that we haven't talked to in 15 years.
Somebody's bound to know somebody who knows somebody. I don't know how people did this before.
The power of the graph.
We just kind of seeded it with, we had a couple of team photos, and we said, I think these are those people, and then that kind of... Kind of expanded.
It helps. It helps to have some people on the team that are very, very networked. So clearly we had a few hubs, but then you get your tendrils, and then it's just a ton of work.
So let's.
These guys have been working on this for weeks.
let's now zoom to where we are today.
Yes.
Because that was then.
Yes.
And now we're now.
Yes.
I don't know anybody.
13 pages. No, sorry.
No, 13 pages. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know.
It's more than 13 pages now.
Slightly more than 13 pages.
Yeah.
But you guys, that you're talking about sort of the, I could see like sort of the kernel of the evolution of what would become what we have today.
Sure.
Which is basically a series of compilers. That you get when you type, the compiler's running, you get IntelliSense, there's a database, there's concurrent transactions.
Yes, yes, yes.
But, you know, that's rock and roll. You guys started that. But I wanted to get your sense of what are you doing today, Jan? What's up? What's your story?
I'm interested in building hardware. So the last few years at Microsoft, I came back to Microsoft in the 2000s. In the last few years, I worked on parallel computing and getting the world ready for multi-core and mini-core. And I helped,
easy stuff.
Helped Simple do the problems. Parallel computing platform stuff that we shipped in VS2010.
Rock and roll, man.
And lots of good stuff there.
Yeah.
But I love computer architecture, and I build multiprocessors with FPGAs, field programmable gate arrays.
Nice.
And, I guess that's my hobby.
Jan's modest. He's like a world authority on
this. It's really interesting stuff.
There's no one alive who knows more about using FPGAs. As general purpose microprocessors, you haven't written a book yet, have you?
No.
You probably should.
Yeah.
I'd say he wrote the book, but he just hasn't written it yet. Yeah.
Well, get on that, man.
Yeah.
Well, that's good to know.
And that's what I'm up to. What are you up to, Rico?
Since 18 months ago, I've been working on Internet Explorer, and there's nothing hard in Internet Explorer.
No.
No problems there. Everything's easy. No, so Internet Explorer has been very challenging, very different, and interestingly, a huge development community, web platform, JavaScript, managed code. You think some skill transfer there? Because all the importance of JavaScript and the DOM model and JavaScript interop. Sometimes I feel like it's deja vu all over again. Like all the things we did with COM interop and in the CLR. It's like all those same kinds of things come up. Again, in JavaScript, and sometimes you use very similar techniques to solve them, sometimes differently. You know, obviously they have a garbage collection solution, and they have garbage collector problems. Their garbage collector's tuned differently than the .NET one was, the different kinds of workloads. Man, but I just feel like there's so much synergy there. So it was very helpful bringing that context to IE, and I'm back to coding in C++ every day. So
excellent.
Yeah.
How do you like that?
Well, some days more than others. some days more than others. But, you know, I'm an old hand at C++, so I'm probably better equipped to jump into the IE code base than a lot of new hires.
Yes.
Now, that's so, like written in the, you know, because we last year, you mentioned going native.
Yes.
And going native was something that was designed to herald in the C++ Renaissance.
Yes.
And it was a C++ Renaissance because, in some sense, Microsoft only talked about .NET for 10 years.
Yes.
That is it.
Yes.
In fact, we tried to shove .NET into the kernel of an operating system, which the researchers pulled off, right? The singularity.
Sure.
Certainly not going to happen with Windows. So we wanted to kind of just put C++ back in the spotlight, and it turns out a lot of good things actually have happened. When you think about the code bases, you're used to, the IE code base, for example, is probably a C++ 98-ish, I would imagine, earlier-ish, kind of.
You mean in terms of like what libraries
language.
It uses?
Yeah, what, the constructs you're using.
So, well, I probably shouldn't go into a lot of details, but you'd find the language usage is actually quite modern.
Really?
Yeah, I think what you'd discover is that you have to be careful about what runtime dependencies you take because you have to run in many different contexts and you want to stay very light. So language constructs are quite modern, but libraries are sort of stick with the basics and build exactly what we need on top of that rather than depending on say standard libraries for this or that. But you know, it's the kind of code you would write if you were trying to write something that needs to run in many different sorts of contexts.
And so what you're saying really is that you don't use exceptions, right?
What I'm saying is
I'm playing with you. I'm sorry.
Maybe not so much STL or...
you know, whatever.
I wanted to play.
Yeah, yeah, I don't want to go there. Yeah.
All right, we won't go there. That's fun, yeah, though. Not, it made you blush, so that's a good sign.
No, that's not. That's really easy to do. That's, we don't get a cookie for that.
Right on.
Yeah.
Well, hey, man, this is great that you guys put this on. It definitely is something to celebrate.
Thank you. Well, and, it's been a great product. I mean, how many software products have had a continuous development life of 30 years? Because before Visual C++, it was 10 years of Microsoft C.
Yeah.
There's always been people working on that product line, right? And how many of them have had a continuous impact and, I mean, still essential tool, it's still relevant to the marketplace.
It's not that many. They're out there, but there's not that many.
Yeah. So I'm grateful to have had a chance to work on something like that in my career.
It's a great thing to do early in a person's career, too.
Yes. I've worked on a number of internal products, and they didn't ship.
Yeah.
And I said, I got to work on something that's doomed to ship, that's guaranteed to ship.
That's right.
Like, no matter what happens, Microsoft has to ship.
I had a conversation with Manny one day, Manny Vellum, when we worked on this stuff. And I said, Manny, could I just work on the linker? I mean, like, the linker's good. We got a link, right? I'll just work on the linker. It'll be fine.
Yeah.
And who knows? I actually ended up I thought I was joking.
Yes.
But, yeah,
did you end up working?
I ended up working on the linker. Yes. So there you go.
Excellent. All right.
Well, hey, thank you for your time.
Lovely talking to you guys.
All right.
Thanks for using our product. Thanks for using VC over the years.
For sure.
All right.
Wow, man, that was cool.
I see. Yeah.
C# 88. That incredible.
Yes.
Hey, man, Jan Gray and Rico, love those guys. They're so humble. They're so nice.
Yeah, that's great, you know.
Really cool stuff.
You know, I like the fact that, you know, C++ is always, you know, down to the meta, always performant.
Yep.
You know, we
But they had to do a lot of work on performance, as we learned in that conversation.
It's always
like
hard.
It never comes for free.
It never comes free. Still now.
Still now, man. But you guys are rocking and rolling. But compilation speeds can be an interesting thing. And we talked about that, of course, back in the early days. It could be really long.
Yeah.
But, you know, tremendous ideas of what those guys did with the database and stuff like that. And so
yes,
you guys are still cranking today. Now, basically, you guys are like a garden of compilers.
Yes.
Right? You have all the front-end compiler stuff, database, the back-end, blah, blah, blah. It's amazing that you guys, you know, how you've evolved from 1.0 to where you are today.
Yes, we do a lot of things. But, you know, we always try to get better. Maybe, you know, one less compiler would not be a bad idea.
Yeah. On that note, rock and roll, brother.